The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, Diara, and Kaya talking about the news that you might not have heard in the past week, and then obviously talking about the election. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Pod Save the People. Here we go.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
I'm Milesy Johnson. You can find me on Instagram at Pharaoh Rapture.
I'm Kaya Henderson, still on the Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
And this is DeRay at DIY on Twitter.
Let my people go.
We're in the
go.
Midst of a critical election. Day by day, it's getting closer. Kamala's pulling up in the polls, neck and neck now. But we have breaking news about Beyonce. So
I'm here to report this as the news reporter that Beyonce received exactly zero nominations at the Country Music Awards. I am floored. But Post Malone received 4 nominations at the Country Music Awards this year. I am interested in what you have to say. I hope that Beyonce releases the visuals for this album the moment the CMAs start, and that she becomes the entire story that night, or that she has like a live show or like gets on Instagram or something. Like, I can't believe she got no nominations is wild to me, given that it was a historic album for any Black person in country and certainly a Black woman. So fascinated to hear what y'all have to say.
I'm not surprised by this at all. What was the song on Lemonade? I think it was on
Daddy
Lemonade.
Daddy Lessons.
Yes, Daddy's Lessons. Whew, that song is so hot with the chicks who are not Dixies anymore. Remember that? First of all, that song is so hot. But remember when that came out and they said it wasn't a country song and they wouldn't allow it in the country category for the Grammys? They've been telling Beyonce she can't come into this space for a long time. And what I love about it is, like, we got to stop looking for validation from the people who don't want to validate us. That's why she went on and made the whole country album anyway, right? So bump the CMAs. Like, all I care about is that those people are still buying her stuff, and later for them. Let's have our own Black Country Music Awards. How about that?
It will be 10 minutes long as of right now.
No, actually.
Let's have the Beyonce Awards.
That's not true.
I'm all about it.
That's not true. There are some awesome Black country folks who don't get the recognition that they need. My friends listen to a lot of them. Country is not exactly my genre, so I can't really put it on. But come on, y'all. I mean, we never got the recognition from the mainstream that we deserve. So why is this surprising?
I don't find this surprising at all. And sometimes, listen, America, sometimes we all got to have our own stuff, okay? It's like cornrows and locks. Those belong to Black people, okay? That's our stuff. These country music awards, however they are populated and however they come to their nomination decision, let these folks have what they want. They can have their music, eat McDonald's while they're at the awards. Let them they can have it. I think the point of this album was Beyoncé saying, again, Black people are the originators of this genre. So we don't need an award because we know what it is and who does it best. So have a grand time at your Country Music Awards. I wasn't going to watch it anyway. I don't even know what channel is it on. It's not a who cares. It's just not for me. So Beyoncé, we congratulate you every day, girl. Every single day. So no love lost on this one, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think I agree with what everybody says. And also, I don't know, y'all. I'm just tired of, and I love Beyoncé. And I guess it's not her, but I'm just tired of like,
I would like the Beehive to know that I don't have anything to do with comments of Miles E. Johnson.
Distancing ourselves.
What I do feel like is that the media like creates like this narrative around her that kind of puts her in this perpetual like victim like stance culturally. Mm-hmm. And I just think that like she's a really rich woman. She knew she wasn't accepted. She did something. She took this. So Dixie Chicks weren't on the Daddy Lesson song. She invited them to collaborate on the CMA performance that year.
Right.
So that was the whole thing. So she's somebody who is a publicity genius who took the tension and the fever. Dixie Chicks were blacklisted from the Country Music Awards because of what they said about George W. Bush. So she's just a master publicity storyteller. And I'm not so sure. I'm like, of course they didn't nominate her because you dissed them. And who cares? I think that the biggest thing that happens from this is that now the CMAs have no legitimacy as an award show. Because no matter how you feel about Beyoncé, no matter how you feel about the music, this is music that has roots in bluegrass, in country, and in folk music, and you didn't nominate it, and it's excellent music. So now you have no legitimacy as an award show, but I'm just not crying like whiskey over Beyoncé not being nominated. Like, I think she's fine.
I'm down with that. not just she's fine, right? Like, I do think that, like, I don't think she cares, right? And I think the genius of her is she creates her own thing,
exactly.
Right? Like, I don't need to be validated by this. Like, I am Beyoncé. I released a country album, whether you like it or
not. She said herself that it's not a country album. It's a Beyoncé album, you know? And I think the most interesting part about Beyoncé when we think about her legacy and who she's like, she shares DNA with. So she shares DNA with like Whitney Houston and Michael Jackson and all these different people is that Whitney Houston, I would argue, partly died because she had to be in this pop position. I feel like Prince and Rick James, their feud is based off of Prince being allowed to be rock and roll and to be all these different things, and then Rick James being in R&B. So I think it's interesting that there's a Black artist that said, I don't care about the genre. I am my own genre of music, and I surpass all and I transcend all of this. And it just makes everybody else look silly because, yeah, if Beyoncé next year comes out with an orchestral classical album, and if it's excellent, it needs to be nominated, or it's not going to legitimize you. You can't just be mad because somebody is diverse in their music output, and that's what it just seems like. It seems very 5 years old. You can't sit with us, and I just like to think that she's flying higher on her private jet than to care about that.
I do remember that Solange tweet when she got snubbed at the Grammys, where Solange was like, let's make our own things, do our own things. Of all the Black artists who could actually have an award show that everybody would not only watch, but be dying to be at, it is Beyoncé. Or even if she put on a concert of Beyoncé's, it could be called Beyoncé and Friends. Everybody would be there. It'd be a whole thing. So maybe that'll be what she does after she stops performing.
That's so funny that you said that, DeRay, because I actually was thinking about that. Not the award show part, but I was thinking like because concert sales are so down in music right now and festivals are up because people can pay one festival ticket and see a lot of different acts. I was like, oh, it would actually be kind of cool if a lot more of these legacy acts create like festival environments. So I was looking at the Busta Rhymes, Ciara, and Missy Elliott tour. And I was like, if you add like three or four more people, you have a festival. And I'm like, and then it will be even crazy to have a Parkwood festival and have Beyonce and Chloe and all the people who are affiliated. I wish that more artists who are so huge, Gaga's, Rihanna's, Beyonce's felt like that. Like, how can I maybe take off the pressure of myself from performing and put it on and transform how we see going to see music? If y'all do that, though.
Well, you know who is thinking that way is my Capricorn twin and queen, Mary J. Blige, who does her own festival now every summer because she's like, also, what y'all not gonna do is pay me less and use my name.
What's it called? Knee highs and wine spritzers.
It's like something like that. Yeah, and it's fabulous.
You better stop talking about me and the auntie crew.
That's me too.
And it'd be so bad.
That's me too.
But I think that's right, Miles. And I think you're also on to something. And you know, one thing I know I'm not is an expert on the Youngs, but something I've read is that young folks also don't listen to music in a genre way as
at all. At all.
So I think that's also something that like these music CM, like all these music awards have to start thinking about is that the young people they're not taking in the music the same way. Yeah.
Repping for the olds, I want to shout out the Fool in Love Festival that happened in LA. I didn't go, but in fact, one of my youngs is the one who hit me to it. And listen to this lineup. Like, if I had known about this, I would have flown to LA. It was Lionel Richie, Diana Ross, Nile Rodgers and Chic, Al Green, Santana, Charlie Wilson, Gladys Knight, the Isley Brothers, Chaka Khan, the Jacksons, the OJs, War, Tower of Power, the Spinners, the Whispers, the Emotions, Dionne Warwick, the Commodores, Smokey Robinson, the Delphonics, the Stylistics, the Manhattans, the Shylights, the Blue Notes, the Intruders, Bloodstone, and a few, George Clinton, Zap, Rose Royce, Morris Day and Time, Heatwave, Kool & the Gang, the Bar K's, Come Function, the Jazz Band, Daz Band, the SOS Band, Shalimar, Cameo, the Mary Jane Girls, Evelyn Champagne, hey. King, the Pointer Sisters, El DeBarge. Yo, how come we didn't know about this?
My knees are hurting just by hearing that list.
Listen. That, I would have gone to that.
But you know another one we should go to that I never go because it ends up being the second weekend of Jazz Fest. And we know I'd be at the Jazz Fest. But it's Lovers and Friends that happens in Vegas. And it's like Usher, Snoop, Keisha Cole, Brandy,
but
Monica.
Canceled this year? Didn't it get canceled this year?
Yeah, because there was like a sandstorm or something wild in Las Vegas.
Yeah. I'm down.
I would love to. I like that one that you were talking about, Auntie Kaya. Once you get to once you start listing the any group that has the in the front of it, I'm like, yes. Oh my goodness.
Speaking of festivals, can I just rant for a minute? And I'm going to try to, I was watching the Today Show this morning and they gave platform to the dude who did, Billy McFarland, who was the guy who organized Firefest. Remember Firefest a couple of years ago? And after serving 4 years in jail for the botched thing, guess what? He is doing Firefest 2. And I'm not telling you anything about it because I don't want you to go or I don't want you to even think about this thing. But it is like peak white male privilege to go to jail for jacking up a festival and then to be like, yep, we're going to do it again. It's going to be better this time. And for primetime TV shows to give him a platform. Now, if I had a fire festival that gave people cold cheese sandwiches and had them sleeping in emergency bunkers after they paid a whole lot of money because they were enticed by Kylie Jenner and Bella Hadid, I would be under the jail. I would not be able to do anything else. And people damn sure wouldn't give me no money to have Kaya Fest 2. But here we are. Welcome to America. I just wanted to know what you thought about that.
And we will be bringing you on the news. You will be our topic number two. We'll be talking about you for 3 weeks.
It's also like, who is buying tickets to this? I don't, like, who, if you buy a ticket to this, shame on you.
Yeah. But he knows that people will, there are going to be, he said they put up these packages and he had 100 people straight out the gate who bought tickets.
Insane.
Yeah.
That is the, and Miles, you talk about this all the time, is that like the allure and the lore of celebrity is just, it overwhelms people's sanity.
What?
And yeah, or replaces it.
And even with it, like this situation, I don't know the entire details, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was no or very minimal celebrity association with this festival, because at this point you have the lore of just being able to post a picture. You're essentially spending whatever the X amount of money is to really have a selfie or have a picture of saying, "Oh, we have we're at the Fyre Festival, you know, and we're here, and this is this funny thing." So it's interesting that even though everything went bad publicity-wise and branding-wise to the Fyre Festival, because it's so infamous, it almost creates this kind of, like, haunted house effect of people wanting to go just to say they can go and to share it and just to, because it's such a ubiquitous, infamous thing in our culture now that it's like, oh, I went to the Fyre Festival. Back in my day, you just went to, like, Six Flags Fright Night. But this feeling like this is like, this is feeling like the 2024 version of that. And just to hook on to what you were saying, Auntie Kaya, too. Do y'all know Anna Delvey?
Of course.
Why is she on Dancing with the Stars?
with her anklet. Better
stop. With her anklet.
You better stop.
Now, I said ice. I said, where's her cage? Like, why? Like, if we care about all these different, it's baffling to me that she's able to be on Dancing with the Stars as we're having these conversations around immigration and all this kind of like propaganda around like immigration being proliferated. Like the fact that Anna Delvey gets to just be twirling around with a bedazzled anklet on Dancing with the Stars. And I think we all know, if you don't know, Anna Delvey is allegedly a white woman. We don't even know. She could be in a whole Scooby-Doo costume. Because she's a scammer, so we don't really know. But
not the Scooby-Doo
right? You'd be like, she unzip her and be like, "Oh my goodness, I thought it was you." But so she's, yeah.
It is, you know, there is no way that a black celebrity would be allowed to be on Dancing with the Stars with an anklet. Like literally, no way in the world.
Okay, so y'all know how I love to dig into some research.
You know the board of Dance with the Stars.
Well, I just, this is sort of sending me a little bit. And I want to do some processing around this later. But this Billy McFarland, because when you go onto his Instagram, which you can go to his Instagram from the website where you can start your application to then get a ticket.
I wonder if the application has social media in it. Because it sounds like he's constructing it to go viral. So if you are less than this amount, then, but go ahead,
and
sorry.
I think that's right, Miles. And I think what it's also conditions of is okay, so on his Instagram, there's a picture of him and Donald Trump. And I did read somewhere at some point that he has been like consulting for the Trump campaign. And then also on his Instagram, it's like MDMA fighting. And like people flipping off of helicopters and like bikinied women on a fast boat. It's sort of like a young modern Trump. Like,
he's selling a lifestyle. Exactly. He's selling a lifestyle.
It's like steeped in sort of like macho and conservatism. It's like Miami Vice, but with the progeny of the leaders of the KKK. It's like, I know that was like a little bit hyperbolic, but you know what I'm saying? It's like scary.
No, I love it.
It's scary. It's like these, so it's this like is like
Brexit Fest.
Right. This is like Scary Island. Come to Scary Island with all of us bros where we can do drugs and who knows what else to you and be completely devoid of reality and humanity on this island. And we'll listen to Ja Rule. Like, that's what this is.
This is also, yes, it's appealing to the, like, fragile masculinity of, you know, the people who feel left out and abandoned and whatnot. And he's selling them back the life that they think they had, right? It is literally people jumping out of helicopters.
It is wild.
What in the
also,
world?
We, just ladies in bikinis. We need to pay attention. This when this weekend comes up.
This is true.
Everyone needs to pay attention to who's out of town. Off work.
That is the truth.
Where are you going? Where are you going?
Right.
Take pictures. I want to see medical bands, all of that. All of that. I want proof. No, you can't go. No, you cannot go. That is so wild that is happening. I just, oh my gosh. But it makes a lot more sense now why it's coming back, because that is an area of people who don't care about that, who don't care about the bad branding or the cold cheese sandwiches.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Moving right along in terms of sort of the polar opposite of that is Kamala Harris, who they about to be so mad. We about to have a black woman president. Maybe they'll get stuck on that island and never want to come back. Kamala Harris dropped her platform this morning, which, you know, listen, every y'all know this. I'm a Hillary Clinton girl, and we had policy up and all over the place, all over the website. And I don't think the Biden campaign ever got around to putting policy things on the website, maybe because they thought a lot of their policy documents lived sort of on the White House page. Nevertheless, there is sort of a whole host of issue areas all in the space of sort of like, I think the theme thematically is called like a new way forward. And a lot of these policies are sort of even more aggressive, approaches to even Biden's policies around, you know, education, healthcare, border, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think part of this too, and this obviously just came in this morning, so we're still digesting it ourselves, really is sort of steeped in opportunity. Where can there be more opportunity? So for listeners, please check it out. It's KamalaHarris.com /issues/front/backslash. I don't know. Google Kamala Harris issues. But what are y'all thinking? Y'all scrolling through, taking a look at this.
I like it. I'm happy it exists. Smart to do it right before the debate so that there won't be a ton of random news articles about it. She'll talk about it at the debate. That'll manage the news cycle. So shout out again to our team who is just executing flawlessly, I think, on these issues. I also love, you'll see that it has a reference to Project 2025 in every single section. So you can see what she proposes. And her team already does the legwork of showing you what the other side is saying. So I thought that was really smart. I was surprised that there's not even like a mention of criminal justice, anything on here. And like, obviously that's my work, so I get it. But you know, even in the part about crime, the part about nobody's above the law, it feels like a real choice to not even signal anything about criminal justice, like not a mention, not a, I don't know, not even the phrase criminal justice. I couldn't find it. I was pretty surprised by that, especially because, you know, her team is still trying to figure out black men, and there's a poll that YouGov just did for young black men, 18 to 29, issues of race and issues of crime are top 2 and 3 issues. They're not at the bottom, which they are for some other, they're not at the bottom for any subgroups, but for black men, they actually are at the very top right after inflation. So, you know, I hope that they figure that out. I hope that they make a passing mention to criminal justice at least, because in the press release they put out, I think over the weekend, that highlighted the 100 officers who are supporting her, they actually do mention the work that the current administration has done around criminal justice. No knocks, use of force, some prison stuff. But in this platform, I actually see nothing, which surprised me, especially because Trump is like, he calls for absolute immunity for all police officers, including the one that killed Sonya Massey. So yeah, I was confused by the absence of criminal justice on this. Like literally just, it's just not there.
I don't know if I was, yeah, I wasn't shocked.
Wait a minute. I have a question. So when I first looked at the thing, there's build an opportunity economy and lower costs for families. And that's a set of things. And then there's safeguarding our fundamental freedoms. And then there's ensure safety and justice for all, which is a little bit of gun violence and crime, not specifically criminal justice reform, but something? No?
No, okay. even protect right. civil rights. I thought it was going to be in protect civil rights and freedoms.
Uh-huh.
She said here, queer.
And it's not. I mean, it's good stuff in there. It is, like, I'm not saying that what's in there is bad. I was shocked that, like, even the, because it's not in ensure safety and justice for all.
For all, yeah.
It's not in civil rights. And okay. I was like, oh, maybe it's going to be in nobody's above the law. Ensure no one is above the law.
Nope. Mm-hmm.
It's not there. So as the first prosecutor, that is a choice to not even signal to it. I was shocked by that. Mm. And I'm voting for Kamala. I like Kamala. I'm team Kamala.
But Dre, when's the last time there's been like a legal system reform something at the White House?
It hasn't been for a while. I'm just saying, I met with Kamala when she was running for president, and she had we're going to do more pattern practice. And
I think that's my point, is that it hasn't been necessarily somebody's job to sort of move it, right? And I think partly you're right. I don't know if it's a choice not to have it, or more so.
I mean, I think
like, I'm curious. Like it is telling, and I really want to ask somebody, and of course I will do that right after we get done recording, what is happening with this piece of it?
Yeah.
Because we live in a democracy and we have access, and as Miles reminds us all the time, you know, I'm an elite Democrat, and so I'm gonna use that.
No, you are above. We can't talk about it right now. But you're the most elitist. you who the other elite Democrats come see once they open the towers. It's you, Hillary.
You above elite?
You're the most elite that has ever elited.
I'm just happy to be in the number.
Okay. Did y'all see Tyreek Hill? Tyreek Hill got punched by that police officer. Like, it just is an issue that is, we went on polling, like, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, Miles, what you guys say?
I just think that, like, it's not right that it's not there, but I think it's, like, obvious why it's not there. I think that that's, like, I think she's trying to win the campaign. And I think there's certain things that she's not going to talk about or address, or she's going to address in a very, maybe even some of the language. Once I hit it, I was like unsatisfied with the language. I see that she cares about it. Uh-huh. I see that she wants to go the right way, but I was like, what's the thing? What's going on? But I think just how I was kind of upset, well, not kind of, I was upset about what she was saying around, what was happening in Palestine with Palestine and Israel. Like, I wasn't satisfied with her reaction to that. I think that we're not going to be satisfied with criminal justice, because that is a huge alienating subject that's just going to alienate people. And I think that right now she wants to win this election, and she does not want to say something that's going to alienate or offend people. And it's actually safer to do that. I remember a couple of episodes ago too, what I'll close with is like, just like a couple of episodes too, back that DR, that you, there was no criminal justice people at the DNC, or like there was no representation of people, of activists and organizers at the DNC. And part of it's because organizing around social justice and race issues and trans issues is alienating to people. And, you know, part of Tim Walz being here is he seems normal and a regular guy, and she's a prosecutor, and she's more conservative than what she's been represented. And all those subjects can really, to me, help that, like, that idea that she's on the radical left. Where I'm living right now, there is nonstop advertisement around mm-hmm. how radical Biden
her
is.
Being a socialist.
And all that other stuff. That's a nonstop narrative that's happening. And I just feel like she's not touching anything that can help that narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, I don't disagree with it, actually. And I'm like Team Kamala. I think that what I've loved about the campaign so far is that they have gone against the advice that everybody told them they had to do. They told them the campaign had to be a certain way. It comes to their own thing. And it is right. She's doing it. I'm like team strategy. What I will say, though, is that this issue, and like I know it well only because I work on it, it just is that when you poll people, it is a top, like we're not losing on the issue with people.
That's right.
Trump is crazy.
That's right.
And Trump is actually calling her. But we're not losing on the issue when we ask people. And I think that if I was her, what I would say is that I'm a prosecutor and I understand both sides. I get it. Nobody should be above the law. The president should be above the law. The police officer shouldn't be above the law. The senator shouldn't be above the law. Your cousin shouldn't be above. Like, I think there's a way to thread this that actually doesn't scare the base, but does remind them that, like, Sonya Massey just got killed and, like, that's not okay. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't expect a paragraph on the police. That I think that she would not do that. I get it. But the phrase criminal justice is here. And I was like, well, that is a choice.
I just wanted to ask about the polls.
Yeah, like when we poll, like any issue around the police, like should they be able to choke people? Should they be accountable? We win across party. Like there's not a...
So it's not race specific or gender specific. Got it.
It's not race. When you poll things like the phrase defund, nightmare, right? Like mm-hmm. that is a losing phrase. But even if you poll, like, should we invest more in communities or not put all the money in police?
And also one of the things that polls well too is should folks get their right to vote back? That is something that even yes. in Florida polls well across both sides. So DeRay.
We're not, when, yeah. the base is there.
But I think it's also, this is part of why it's so important to make sure you have strong voices tapped into the people in these rooms, because somebody needs to be able to look at this and be like, you know what we're missing? And it's, and partly why it's because, yes, the opioid crisis is a major crisis, but over 2 million people being incarcerated is a crisis. That is one of America's, that we are at a crisis and have been for decades there. So there's just, DeRay, like what you're highlighting is correct. It's like there has to be a way to bring it to the forefront, to talk about it in a way. And DeRay, this is the work too, I want to look at again with Veer Institute around even how we talk about the word safety, like even how we're talking about these issues is so sort of old school and not nuanced. And that's how we're losing people as well, or just kind of staying stuck in the same conversation and perspective. But everything, I agree with everything that everyone's saying, and somebody will be held accountable.
Okay. And that's from, OG boss liberal elites.
So I'll start with the news. I'm obsessed with adult literacy. Obsessed, obsessed, obsessed. I'm obsessed with it, not only because adults need to be able to read, but I think about adult literacy as a public safety strategy, that if you're 17, 18, 22, 25 and can't read, you're just making different choices in the world. So my article is actually from 2022, ProPublica. It's titled, A Fifth of American Adults Struggle to Read. Why Are We Failing to Teach Them? I did not know, and Kai, you probably knew this because Kai is the OG, you know, she is education, everybody. If you do not know, Kai Henderson is that girl. I didn't know that a part of the warm poverty way back in the day was actually putting money into adult literacy. I had no clue. Now, one of the challenges is that the amount of money they put in, $600-ish million to the states, has remained the same when adjusted for inflation over the years. So we haven't invested more money in it. And what I did know, and I didn't know that it was like more earnest at the beginning. It was like teach people how to read so that they could do their jobs well, they can understand their bills, and, you know, reading limits your career mobility. You can't be a manager if you can't read the handbook and things like that. So there's some stories in the article that talk about people where the supervisors are being shipped in from other places, not because of racism per se, but because the people can't read and they got to figure out how to have a management structure that reads. Now, what it was helpful to actually see written here is that somewhere along the way, we transitioned from actually just teaching people how to read to one of the consequences of this idea of measuring everything meant that we were teaching people how to get high school credentials and get college credentials. And if you've ever seen the GED course is not a literacy course. It's not a comprehension course. The GED course will teach you, you know, like in the, I taught math and, you know, if you get your GED, I'm not convinced you're like a, you know, a solid math student, but you know how to take a test really well. And somewhere along the way, we transitioned from sort of purely teaching people how to read to job readiness and GED programs. And we really screwed up, it seems. So what the article does a really good job of is showing that across the country, there are huge swaths of adults who just cannot read. And cities and states don't have any structured programs for them. And that even when they do have programs, they either don't have enough money to have a full program so they can like get people in, but can't pay for the tests, can't pay for the books, can't pay for quality instruction, or people can't balance their job and the literacy program. And it was just really fascinating to me to read. You know, the first time I ever believed that we could do adult literacy at scale was in Minneapolis. In Minneapolis, there are over 100 languages spoken in our school, in the schools in Minneapolis. There are only 70 schools. So even when I was hiring staff, it's hard because you're like, you know, I got to find a teacher who can teach the Egyptian kid. You know, I'm like, I'm really out here trying to find, and they don't have great licensure laws. So I'm doing creative things to get teachers. But what the district actually offers on the top floor of the school system building in Minneapolis is adult education. So parents, community members will come into the building and learn how to read. They learn math on the top floor of the school board building. It was like a whole department that we staffed that was adult education. School system ran it. People came. It was a thing. You know, I'd be leaving the building at 5. I'm like, well, who are all these people in the lobby? It's people for adult education. And I was like, oh, this is actually the first time I've ever seen this done that wasn't like ushered in a community college or wasn't like sort of a random nonprofit doing a GED program. And I, you know, whenever I sunset on fighting the police, adult literacy is I'm obsessed with this idea of what do we do with the huge amount of adults who cannot actually read. And I didn't know that there was this ProPublica article about it. I'm obsessed with ProPublica. They do incredible work. And I wanted to bring it here to see what you all thought.
Auntie Kaya, we need you to take the floor. Guide us with your light.
I mean, this article brings up so much for me. The first thing that I guess I will say is, you know, teaching reading is not an easy thing. In fact, we struggle to teach young people how to read. And only recently are we having real conversations about the science of reading, what it actually takes to teach people to read. There are not enough reading teachers in the K-12 system. And so it would stand to reason that there are not enough adult educators out there. You have to add to the teaching of the skills, the sort of deconstruction of all of the shame and guilt of being an adult and not being able to read. But I think I'm sort of encouraged by some of the influencers. I can't remember the guy's name, but remember the social media dude who couldn't read? He's a fitness instructor. And he was like, look, I'm gonna figure this out and whatnot. I think one, we have to figure out how to destigmatize illiteracy. And, you know, I think about Cuba, who, and I mean, Diarra, you know this better than a lot of people, that made a policy decision at the governmental level that said, we're going to teach everybody to read. We're going to send people out into the countryside. We are going to Maestra, right? Like, that's the film. Like, we are going to teach people to read because reading unlocks everything else in the world. And I think, you know, I'm thinking a lot about we're going into this debate. We're talking about policy decisions. The reason why some of these places have solid adult literacy, or why some places have solid adult literacy programs, is because they've made a policy decision to support their people. There's governmental funding for it. In the ProPublica article, it's astounding to look at states like Nebraska and Louisiana that spend $5 or $2 on adult education. Like, that, that is a policy decision to keep people subjugated, to keep people poor, to keep people depressed and out of our economy. And I think that we can make very different decisions.
So as of late, my partner, my boyfriend, works with grades 5 through 8, fifth grade through eighth grade. And, you know, as we like gossip and talk about our days and stuff like that, what's been so interesting is him talking about how everything around the school is just is mainly around behavioral containment. Mm-hmm. It's really about it's about around behavior. It's around making sure children are outlined. He says, and this is like kind of what he's talked to other teachers about too, just at different schools, is that so much of the focus has really made education second, third, fourth on the list, specifically for children. And I do think there's some type of connectivity between what he's going through in this report, because, you know, it's been years since I've been in school, but what I keep on hearing from everybody who I know who's in public education is that the environment and the nature of school in a lot of places, specifically places in the Midwest, specifically places in the South, has totally changed, and it's been more about just keeping all the kids in line and doing well. And I feel like we're seeing that. And I can't sell it hard enough how, and DeRay explains it too, how illiteracy stops your life. It totally puts a ceiling on your life, a very low, small New York studio apartment ceiling on where your life can go if you cannot read. And this is tinfoil hat on. I think a lot of Republicans know these stats. And I think what they're doing with education, I think that how they're trying to defund education, how they're trying to destroy public education, I think that they want to create a permanent lower class that always needs to use their mind, or excuse me, always needs to use their body for labor to ensure that billionaires always have people to source. So once that person gets cancer because of where they were working, or once this person blows their back out because of the box that they lifted, there is always this infinite supply of people who have to sell their time and their body in order to make ends meet. And I think that's how come these stats look so ridiculous in America. America with Wi-Fi and plumbing system, America. I think that's why these stats are able to exist, is also because I think there are people who are interested in this existing and happening like this, because this is embarrassing too, just as a nation, to have any types of stats. I don't care where it is in the country. These are embarrassing, humiliating stats that no nation should want to be able to sign off on. So
the only thing I'll add, I agree with everything. The only thing I'll add is that I don't know why, but this is making me think of my dad, who when we did just always was just this notion of being curious and also understanding how important it is that reading is. It, it is like the thing that helps you be able to transform society. Like, since I was little and understood that my dad was a lawyer and a criminal defense attorney and like what that meant, and then got curious around Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston and Constance Baker Motley, like, and also just growing up in DC, you know, RIP to DC in the 80s and 90s, like, you know, you would just absorb stories about Ida B. Wells or Dorothy Height. Like, they're just, gosh, man, just this like beautiful environment of how important reading and knowledge and how all of that was so important to your identity, right? So I think, Dre and Miles, what y'all both are saying, just in terms of like, there's a ceiling on yourself, like, quite literally, because you can't learn about who you are and what the contributions of your people have been without this, you know. And obviously, back in my elitism, this is, we're really talking about being able to get a job. But, you know, in my family, whether you were a migrant worker or worked in a factory, or everybody was reading. My granny was reading her black sex books until way in the later years. Okay.
Drop the
title. My granny worked at Honeywell for 30 years. It's a factory. You know what I'm saying? So all the,
Dara, do you think that the screens have contributed to this? And hearing you talk, do you think that it's like technology,
I think,
or
so,
just for anybody, I guess?
I think so, but I think it's also just the captions. It's
You have to read on social media. Right. Like, you can't, there is no getting away from this.
Yeah.
Not on TikTok.
Not much, but even still, there's stuff, look, the captions that go across, come on. You need to read, period.
It's just something's missing. I don't know if all these different epidemics we've had in the Black community, whether it's drugs or gun violence or lack of resource or gentrification in all of our cities, like, there, that's why I spend so much time in New Orleans, because it doesn't, and there's been huge change there, but it don't feel like DC. And I love my city, but it's like all of these things have contributed to, I don't know, y'all. It's something going on. Somebody need to write
but
a book.
But y'all, class stratification, like, I hate saying, like, I know
exactly.
I speak about it
exactly.
All the time.
Because your New Orleans ain't everybody's
that's
New
right.
Orleans.
And
it's a whole lot of people
right.
in New Orleans who can't read.
And ignoring that, I think, like, specifically, like, I seen it. I was born in 91. So it just feels like I was in this weird spot where I can look backwards and forwards in
that's
this really,
right.
like, interesting way. But I'm like, those people, Black people who had to, because of segregation, had to work with each other, had to go to school with each other.
That's
they have
right.
a different education than the Black people who were able to move out, who were able to leave during and go to different neighborhoods. And I can promise you, like, I mean, this not happening for DR for many of reasons, some private, some whatever, but like, if DR's child was going to a rural school in Minneapolis, that would be a different experience for every poor kid in there too, because liberal elite DR's child is going to get treated, it's just going to change the effect. But there's nobody
That's
at
right.
these schools who yeah. Who they're invisible
That's
children.
Right.
They're
That's
invisible,
right.
forgotten,
That's right.
forgotten children. And if you don't have a Louise Gates child going to your school, that's going to change how your school interacts and gets taken care of. And I think Black
That's
people
right.
have totally separated class-wise, and it's only getting thicker. And I think we're seeing results of that separation.
Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing, and this is a real thing in Washington, D.C., where Black people, one, had concentrated Black excellence. Two, thought the water was colder on that side of town, and so fled. And then, you know, I remember having conversations with parents whose kids started out in DC public schools with old Black lady teachers who were like making sure these babies could read. And then they, you know, ascended and got to go to private white, you know, wealthy white private schools, and their kids were depressed, had anxiety, blah, 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 and whatever, whatever, because it's not just about the academics that you get. It is also about the socialization and the, and you know, the sort of whole child stuff. And so we watched families who were struggling even though they were in the best schools, and I think that, or the quote unquote best mm-hmm. schools. And so I think that part of what we need to remember is, in fact, like, people make different decisions for other people's kids, right? And there is something very different to us being in community. I mandated that my staff, you can't lead in DC public schools and have your kids go into private schools, because while I respect everybody's mm-hmm. ability or right to do whatever they think is right for their kids, how can we tell parents that they should send their kids to our schools if we don't send mm-hmm. our kids Ooh. To our schools, mm-hmm. right? And so that was the thing. My kids were in DC public schools and I didn't win the lottery. I didn't get into the best schools. My kids were in the neighborhood schools, right? And what we don't realize is that there are assets in these neighborhood schools. There are assets in communities. There are little old Black ladies who know how to teach people to read. They ain't been to the science of reading professional development, but they know how to teach people to read. And we have to activate people outside of institutions because there are so many assets in our communities. Right. And the government can actually help to support that. I'm about to argue the exact opposite when my news comes, so don't hold me hostage.
But so she said, I'm just going to be clear.
Yeah.
So my news today, y'all, is about the 19th. And I often get my news from the 19th, but it's a nonprofit newsroom and it's entering its fifth year and it's growing and growing and I'm so excited. And so the 19th, it sort of was birthed out of 2016 with Hillary Clinton's loss. And I think they were, you know, there's sort of Aaron Haynes, who's the founding reporter. There just was growing frustration around traditional news media and how it wasn't really ready or equipped to cover women in political life. And so nearly 5 years later, this news outfit covers politics and policy with a focus on gender. It's continuing to cover the presidential election cycle. What an incredible time. I like to go from 16 to start where you're starting because the loss of this woman. And now here you are 5 years later and growing in a space where our candidate is a Black woman. So Emily Ranshaw and a co-founder, Amanda Zamora, they started in January 2020 with just one reporter and no website. Since then, it's grown into a digital operation that has raised nearly $60 million and has 55 million people working there. And I just wanted to bring this to the pod because, y'all, for our listeners, we are sometimes prepared and sometimes scramble with our news. And sometimes we can't find news. And partly why we can't find news is because, well, this is more for me, Kaya, and Miles. We're looking for, like, joyful, uplifting news, where DeRay is always looking to bring us down, as he did today. As he did today.
Down.
And so, but
reminding you where we are.
He was like, that art show is nice, but the children. So
don't black throw yourself into prison, child.
So it is so wonderful to have sources like the 19th where you can actually find sort of curated news for what your values are. And they also, and it's like good, truthful, fact-based news that just has a point of view. And so I think I know I often go to them when I'm looking and I really want to find something good. I always go to the 19th and typically can find what I'm looking for, because it is covering sort of subject areas and individuals that traditional news media wouldn't cover, and you know, sort of local races that are happening. Those candidates, you know, if they're women, particularly women of color, I can always find what I need to find about those candidates on the 19th. So, yeah, I just wanted to bring it here. I'm very excited. Shout out to them for continuing to grow. I think they're also up for a bunch of other multi-million dollar endowments and grants. And I hope they get them all. I hope y'all get every dollar that you applied for. I hope you get that coming in. So I just wanted to bring this, just want to highlight them as a platform, and then just to congratulate them around their continued success.
I remember when they first started, and it's cool to see them growing, because there were a lot of news outlets that sort of tried to start around 19 and 20 that did not survive. So to see them not only still be here but grow is actually really awesome. So shout out to the 19th.
I thought this was really, really interesting. First of all, I didn't know about it, so thanks, Tiara. And I signed up for their weekly newsletter, which all of our listeners should do if we want to support the folks. There were a couple things that stood out to me. One is, you know, back to this conversation about creating your own thing. When people are not doing what you need to do, we actually all have the power to go create our own thing. And I think that there is a revolution happening in the media world where quite a few people are creating new news outlets because they, you know, argue that the traditional news outlets aren't meeting the mark or are too partisan or what have you. And I think this, the business model of this is very interesting. They didn't start out trying to be a full-fledged, you know, news outlet. They did good articles and then they put them in other people's publications. So they put stuff in the Washington Post and they put stuff in other places. And one, that not only strengthens their reputation and their reach, it means that you don't have to stand up a whole, you know, organization in order to do that. So it's smart, but it also strengthens the quality of the Washington Post and these other major news outlets. And I thought that that was kind of cool. The other thing that I felt super excited about is this idea of they got a big grant from Melinda French Gates and they use it toward an endowment. And I'm obsessed right now, DeRay, with endowments, because when you are in the nonprofit space, you spend most of your time not doing the work, but hustling for the dollars to do the work. And in my new role, you know, we got a huge contribution and we set it up as an endowment. For those people who don't know, an endowment is a large chunk of money that you put in the bank and the interest spins off every year enough. If you have a good enough endowment, it will spin off enough money to pay for your operations. And so what we didn't want to do was run around and fundraise every year, but to have a significant enough of an endowment that every year we get a check from the bank that covers our operations. And I think that we have to start thinking differently about how to make the nonprofit space sustainable. People can't keep doing these jobs when they're burning themselves out, fundraising and all of these kinds of things. Oh. And so I think it sets a couple of really good examples about how to make this kind of work much more sustainable for the long term. So shout out to the 19th for not just doing good work, but for changing the game.
I echo what everybody else said. Thank you for bringing this, Diara. I'm so passionate about media, specifically people on the left having media. I think that as many platforms, as many newspapers, as many channels and video sources, Instagram pages, whatever, I think as many of those things that can exist, the better. I've had countless, I actually can't count them. I had a few conversations with DeRay around just trying to push him to do something I just think as many people who can create stories in media who are on the left side as possible, it's just, we just need it. So I love hearing that something is successful and still living and growing, because I know that it can be really, really hard, but it's so essential, specifically when we get to times like this where we're in an election year, or when something's controversial or important happens and you need trusted spaces to be able to not just report on it, but also be able to examine it. And I love hearing that there's a space that is successful.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
My news this week is actually related to, I wish I had known that Vice President Harris was releasing her policy platform this morning, because this kind of relates. It actually relates pretty specifically. So I just didn't know that before this morning. So thanks, DeRay. But I want to share some news this morning about what I learned, some more about what I learned about Project 2025. So as most of you already know, Project 2025 is the Republican kind of wish list of policies for a second Trump presidency. It was created by the Heritage Foundation, which is a leading conservative, like a radically conservative think tank that is staffed by many of the former Trump administration officials who are expected to go back into the government if Mr. Trump is reelected president. And it contains some pretty controversial proposals. So you've heard things like they want to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education. They want to decrease taxes on rich people and raise taxes on poor and middle class people. They want to cap Medicaid, which would cut off lots of people's access to health care. They want to eliminate Head Start, all these kinds of things. But I recently learned that the plan also calls for defunding child care. What? Child care, right? Bread and butter is what we all think is important. Apparently, not these folks. So the plan calls for shifting funding away from universal daycare or daycare centers, as we know them, to in-home family care, because they claim that children who go to child care, to daycare centers, are more likely to suffer from anxiety, depression, and neglect. Did you know that? How many people here went to childcare?
I went to childcare.
Right. And
I went to Wee Pals.
Right. And I mean, maybe you suffered from anxiety, depression, and neglect, but we don't have any evidence that that came from your daycare experience. In fact, where is the research to back that up, you might ask? There is no research at all. What the text states is, without evidence, it says prioritize funding for home-based childcare, not universal daycare. Without evidence, it adds concurrently, children who spend significant time in daycare experience higher rates of anxiety, depression, and neglect, as well as poor educational and developmental outcomes. Instead of providing universal daycare, funding should go to parents, either to offset the cost of staying at home with a child or to pay for familial in-home health care. Now, one of the things that this really brought up for me is the whole rant that I have been on about these educational savings accounts, because that basically prioritizes giving money to individual parents and families to make their own educational decisions. And as we've seen both in Arizona and in Indiana, I think, DeRay, you sent the Indiana stuff recently, the results have been catastrophic. The people who benefit most are the wealthy people. The people who benefit least are the poor people. And the people who pay for it are the public, which is not how this is supposed to go. These folks also claim that the overtime pay requirement, protections that the government has put in place to make sure that workers get overtime pay if they deserve it, that that actually discourages employers from offering childcare benefits. So in addition to decreasing universal childcare, they want to scale back overtime pay protection for workers. Who do we think is most affected by this? Women, poor people, middle-class people, working people are all the targets of these policies. 96% of daycare owners are women, 96%. So these people will lose their livelihood. 58% of working parents rely on childcare centers. God, what would it look like if 60% of our working people no longer had access to childcare centers? 70% of young mothers in the United States work and use childcare, and only 30% of infants and toddlers go to home-based childcare. So again, we'll see massive amounts of money move to small handfuls of people. You know what those people look like. And the people who will suffer are the most vulnerable kids who need it most. If you've been paying attention to J.D. Vance, he's been signaling this, right? He's been talking about grandparents and family members helping out to alleviate childcare costs. Well, you can imagine that there'll be a lot more of them if they're getting a check from the federal government after they've shut down your local childcare place. And we already know how he feels about working women who he says prioritize their careers over having children. You know, he's talked about childless cat ladies and all of that kind of thing. And so I brought this to the pod because I think, one, it ties into the piece about the educational savings account that more than 22 states now have. I now am excited that it came out today that Vice President Harris, in her policy platform, has explicit policies around protecting Head Start, protecting and expanding childcare, expanding the childcare tax credit, which pulled millions of kids out of poverty during the pandemic. And I brought this because, I mean, Dore, you mentioned earlier the war on poverty. Like, the war on poverty used to mean that we were using our tools and resources as a government to fight poverty and to provide Americans with a better way of life. But these Republicans are actually declaring war not on poverty, but on poor people and middle class people. And I think we can't and we won't let that happen.
So I have a lot of thoughts. First is I will just shout out to her including this in the policy platform. My last plug for criminal justice is that the cost of criminal justice is just so wild. So it's an estimated $230 billion total reduction in lifetime earnings for incarcerated people. And that is mostly people of color who are disproportionately incarcerated. So I'll start there. But what is what's really interesting to me about this is that if you put a white man in a suit, people just think it makes sense. They like give people credit for it. And the ideas are just so wild. And people like, they stand up there in suits and they're like, we are investing in home childcare. And you're like that, I don't know, it is nuts. And the fact that they are getting away with the media pretending as if this is like a same incredible idea is actually really fascinating to me. I use this as just one of them, but I think that the Republicans do that well. They get up in suits, they say things that are totally nonsensical, and people give it credit as if it's like a sane idea, whereas if we got up there in a hoodie and said anything like this, we would be the wild da-da-da, no matter how many degrees and stuff you had. So I'm interested in the performance of all of this. But I also am, you know, what the Republicans get is that who has the most money anywhere? The government. And they're like, it's more money than we have as people, and we deserve it. That's it. That is like what this all boils down to me. So they're like, get rid of childcare, screw those people. They don't matter anyway. And we will figure out how to siphon the money back to families that look like ours, because the process is going to be one that only they can fit. Like the voucher thing, you know, you invest vouchers so you can do whatever you want. But the way the process is set up, only certain people can even participate in it in the first place. And, you know, I don't know if it's storytelling or what, but I will say in my organizing, when I try and tell people this stuff around this or in incarceration, I don't know what it is. And I'm interested, you know, Miles, you're the culture savant, but, you know, people really do. They think that it's like a conspiracy. They think when you say it to them, they're like, couldn't possibly be that. They're like, no. And you're like, I don't know. They really go get rid of Head Start. Head Start is the only reason why you got somebody to watch your child. That's it. It's the only thing you got down the street. Head Start is all you got. Your mother is, the grandparents today are still working. My great grandmother moved in with us when she was 65. She helped raise us. She could do that. She had retired, da da da. They can't do that right now. 65 year olds are going to work. My father's turning 65 on the 15th, and he is far from retirement. You know, he couldn't move in with my sister and the kids if he wanted to. But you tell people some of this stuff and they're like, oh, well, it's always been bad. And I'm like, well, no, it wasn't always the end of childcare. That is crazy. I don't know.
I was watching over this weekend, I was watching Hillbilly Elegy because Glenn Close plays the grandmother, Meemaw, in the film adaptation of J.D. Vance's memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. And what was so horrible movie, Glenn Close, she's a gift because she really ate that role up. But like as far as storytelling and just, it was just such a trite, Hallmarky movie. But as I was reading this article, I was glad that I watched it because it's such an unserious, deeply unserious idea because it kind of situates itself on a perfect American family dynamic that doesn't exist. So the first thing I think about are all the people who don't have the grandparents, don't have the family. Grandparents are working. It just creates this idea that you have a 10, 8, whatever generation long American family lineage, and you have two grandparents on each side, and all this can happen that way. It feels like it's just totally ignoring people who live outside of that. And I also think, and I guess DeRay hinted at this, just said it, I think that's the design of it. Again, I think sometimes, and like what Kaya said around, oh no, this is not a war on poverty anymore, it's a war on the impoverished. So it's hard for me, in the same way that I was saying about the literacy stuff and the illiteracy stuff, it's hard for me not to think that they know that there are these imperfect families, and what we want to do is make it so these families don't exist within a couple of generations, because we've made these laws in these policies. So if you have a family like this, if you make I don't want to call a child a mistake, but if you make a mistake or something happens, or when anything happens that makes you poor or makes you impoverished or put some class or race onto your situation, we want to make sure that kind of family doesn't even have a chance to persist, because I feel like there is a resentment in seeing the people from the single family households and the single working mom households be in DC or be rich or disturb their plans. So I think they want to make sure that there's not a world where essentially a Barack Obama can happen again, because that is a person who, from the sounds of it, wouldn't be able to exist and be able to have the path that he had without assistance. So anybody who comes from outside of this world can never get this kind of power again, and that's how I see it. Like there's it. I don't know. I don't know if my tinfoil hat's too tight or what, but it's really hard for me not to see it, because I'm like, you know, there's other types of families here who can't fit into that policy. And I think that's the point, that they don't fit into it and they disappear. And in a couple of generations, we don't have to deal with them. So, y'all, I want to bring the happy news. You know, there's certain people, I have horrible parasocial relationships with a lot of people. And within the last 10 years, they have been dropping like flies. One that has sustained is my relationship with Sade. Sade is the soundtrack to my mama's 30s, which means it's the soundtrack to my childhood. And I love her so much. And I'm so excited about this news. This news comes from Variety. And it reads, the reclusive singer-songwriter will release Young Lion as part of the Transa Benefit album arriving on November 22nd. The project, assembled by nonprofit Red Hot, is intended to support transgender awareness and spotlight both trans and non-binary artists. Young Lion is dedicated to Sade's son, Isaac, who identifies as a transgender man. Variety, stop saying people identify as a transgender man to say who is a transgender man. That makes it so we're not making people's gender stories up for debate. Anywho, we're being positive. Quote, we started talking about all the gifts that trans artists have given the world and wanted to create a red hot project that centered and celebrated those gifts, says Dust Reed, who put together Transa alongside artist Massima Bell. We hope to create a narrative that positions trans and non-binary people as leaders in our society insofar as the deep inner work they do to affirm who they are in our current climate. We felt this is something everybody should do, whether you identify as trans or non-binary or otherwise. If you took the time to explore your gender, get in touch with the feeling side of yourself, and maybe we would have a future oriented around values of community, collaboration, care, and healing. So not only am I excited that this is going to exist in the world, obviously, and I love Sade, so I mean, she could really be releasing a song around a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and I would tune in to listen to it. But I also think that there is such this anti-LGBTQ IA plus narrative, specifically as it pertains to Black people. And I think a lot of times when I see things that intersect queer news, trans news, or ideas in Black folks, usually it has a cis heterosexual Black person mm-hmm. as villain mm-hmm. and as trans person as victim. And I like the idea of a Black mom, a Black mom who we love, who is not fame guzzling, or there's just none of those narratives that people can put around it. She minds her business in between projects. And this statement is not just saying she loves her Black child who is trans, but also it's this bigger public thing. Just simply by her giving her art. And I think it really pushes back on this narrative that cis heterosexual Black women, specifically cis heterosexual older Black women, are inherently transphobic or inherently homophobic. And I just love that because I think that there's just a few artists. I mean, every artist that Auntie Kaya listed at that festival is one of those people, but there are some huge legacy acts and artists who have these cultural cachets and power in our society to make things seem normal, to make things seem respectable. If Sade says she's okay with something, it hits us different than if anybody else says it from the Gen Z generation. Even when I was watching Marlon Wayans speak to Shannon Sharp. I was like, that big man, Shannon Sharp. He would, Marlon Wayans was talking about his trans child, and there was something inside of seeing a Black man accept his trans child with all the language fumbling that we get and just all that stuff and all those critiques that we can give how that was explored. At the end of the day, that was a cis heterosexual Black man embracing his queer trans child publicly. And there's been such a narrative that Black folks don't like trans people, don't like queer people. And I love that this is going to exist as a counter narrative for that. And it's happening in a way that feels organic to Sade's brand, that feels generative. It doesn't feel like a political thing. It feels like, what would you do if you had a child who you loved and who you saw their journey as a Black mom? You would make something called Young Lion. And it's so her. And it doesn't say, I'm having a hard time articulating what I'm like, exactly what I'm seeing, but it sounds like something Sade would say. You know, it feels like something that came from her core that she gave to this thing. It doesn't feel like she was politically seduced into creating something. It feels like, oh no, this feels authentic to the Sade that we know. And I just love that this was coming out. I love that this exists. I can't wait to hear it. On this as well, there are a couple of other acts that are on this. So a lot of the news stories that I've seen have been around Sade, but according to this article, Sam Smith is going to be a part of it, which sounds about right. But also Andre 3000 is going to be a part of it. When it comes to original songs, there's going to be a lot of mixes with this, but there's also going to be original songs, and Andre 3000 is counted as one of the people who are going to be giving original songs. And I think that's amazing. I think that Andre 3000 is so respected in patriarchal hip hop, and he's always on somebody's top 10 10 list. And I think him doing something that shows that he is in support and has an open mind around queerness and transness is really powerful. And I'm all for this. And I can't, you know, of course, Dwayne Wade and Gabrielle Union. I'm just all for more Black people, specifically older Black people, middle-aged Black people who get it, being public about getting it, because I think it's such a great, great, great counter-narrative. So I want to bring this all to y'all because I was excited and hopefully my excitement is contagious and I'm getting my little midriff ready. I have my incense blowing. I got my, I'm be vegetarian for the 3 minutes and 13 seconds that song is. However long the song is, I'm like, oh, I'm vegetarian. I'm like some incense. I'm gonna have some sheer curtains. You know how Sade gets you into the mood. So I'm gonna,
For me, I'm going to have to find a way to make myself a pullback slick ponytail, okay. my big silver hoops, my all black dress with no shoes on, and my bright, bright red lipstick. Because yes. I mean, first of all, anytime you hear that Sade is bringing out some new music, it is a cause for celebration. Definitely soundtrack of my teens, 20s, 30s, all of the things. This is actually interesting. So I had two posters in college that I had on my walls for all four. Well, one for 4 years and one for 3 years. One was this huge poster of Sade and one was the Wings poster of Michael Jordan. And I carried them with me from my freshman dorm to my sophomore apartment, to my junior dorm, to my senior apartment. And what was interesting is Sade lasted the whole of college and Michael Jordan did not, because I decided, Miles, that I didn't want to mess with Michael Jordan because he was not using his platform for good. In fact, I felt like the whole entire world, if Michael Jordan said, eat strawberry ice cream, everybody in the world would eat strawberry ice cream. He transcended race, class, gender, everything. And we, at that moment in my life as a radical, you know, 20-year-old, I was like, you need to be telling these people how to make the world right. You need to be talking about divesting from South Africa. You need to be talking about Rodney King. You know, all of the issues of our time, you need to say something about. And I felt like he was not. And, you know, he was like, that's not my job. The whole I'm not a role model thing, all of that. And while I feel like people have the right to make that choice for themselves, I had the right as a young sort of strident person to not support that. That's not where I want to put my time and my energy. And so that brings me right back to this, right? Like, I want to put my time and energy and support around people who use their platform to extend their power to other people, to fight for what's right and to do good. And again, like, I don't get to criticize you if you don't want to use your platform, but I do get to take my money, my time, my attention and put it in the places that I think are going to help change the world. So I appreciate Sade for that. I think, Miles, you're right that not just Sade because she's a singer or she's the bomb and she's super cool and we all love her, but because she is a 50 or 60 something year old Black woman, it matters differently than other people doing this. And the other thing that this made, and the other thing that this made me think about is everybody that you named, all of the stars that you name who have done this, have family members who are trans. And the reason why Black people can't be anti-trans or anti-gay is because we all got family members who reflect the rainbow. And I think that while it messes up our supposed church, you know, image or whatever, for some people, if you really know Jesus, you know that the Jesus that I serve created us all. And you could be mad at me if you don't like that statement, but we are all part of the human family. And so I think when we think about each other as family, it makes us stand up for the people who we love. And so shout out to Sade, shout out to everybody in our family, and let's find more ways to see each other as family members.
And before you go, DR, as well, just to guess everything you said about the Jesus you serve, but if we really want to get real about Black people in church, also about who's serving these choirs.
Honey, listen, the choir director, the pianist.
So we ain't even got to go far back to BC to find Jesus was okay with LGBTQ people. Some part of y'all are okay with it too, because who's making the music?
That's right. That's right.
Miles, thank you for bringing this to the pod. I'm very excited. I'm also excited. You left them out, but it makes sense because you're young. But Wendy and Lisa, who are lesbian icons.
Yes.
Okay, who are part of Prince and the Revolution, who are the co-writers of Computer Blue,
have done... I love that song.
Wendy and Lisa. Hello, Wendy. Yes, Lisa.
Yes. you know you got a whole wife, right?
Y'all, it's early. That didn't even click to me.
Well, and they did an I Would Die For You cover that's on this.
Yes.
That's a part of this project. So I'm so excited about all of this. But also, so the nonprofit that put this together, Red Hot, I didn't know about this nonprofit. And they've been doing this since like the early 90s, around, you know, the AIDS epidemic. And so they've worked with all kinds of incredible artists, from David Bowie, like so many.
Maybe we can get them on the podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's nothing that I love more, or that I think is actually more effective to changing hearts and minds, than projects like this. Like when we really start to fold in culture and sort of and to start from that place, to then create a work that really pulls people in and celebrates people. I just think that's where it at. And I want to read something too. So Red Hot executive director Dust Reed, who assembled Transa with artist Massima Bell, told Variety, "We hope to create a narrative that positions trans and non-binary people as leaders in our society insofar as the deep inner work they do to affirm who they are in our current climate. We felt this is something everybody should do, whether you identify as trans or non-binary or otherwise. If you took the time to explore your gender, get in touch with the feeling side of yourself, maybe we would have a future oriented around values of community, collaboration, care, and healing." Word yes. up. Man. Red Hot, mm-hmm. We're coming to look for you. Thank you. So thanks so much, Miles. I love this.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.